It was so good to catch up with Jackie Double, who is my nostalgia interview guest this week. Jackie works in student support in the School of Arts at the University of Kent. We learn about her upbringing in North Wales and then the Potteries. Her father was a fireman. She tells us that she was an inquisitive child. Her parents were Mormon. She talks about the buildings that she remembers from childhood and walking to school. We learn about her religious sensibilities when she was younger and her experiences of growing up in faith environments and the limitations thereby. Different friendship communities that have been built up is something that we go on to talk about, and what happens when you have children with challenging medical circumstances. She was the first in her generation to go to university. She talks about how there was no option of going back after her room was rented out. She had to make choices to enable her to live independently. She was a teacher. She worked for a theatre company. I think one of the abiding themes that runs through the interview is how much of a practical person Jackie is. She isn't somebody who looks back and regrets things. She wasn't really interested in music when she was growing up. Her childhood was more book-based. She would read a book a day. We talk about embracing the world of Kindles, and she read English literature at Sheffield. She tells us why she should have been a Renaissance male and why she's interested in reading the book that an author was reading when they were writing a book that Jackie is reading, if that makes sense, and why she loves to reread a book. We talk about what happens when you meet your heroes, and Jackie talks about how she had to work to get through university. She talks about not necessarily doing all the things she wanted to do. She tells us why she thinks you can be nostalgic about negative experiences. We talk about letting things go and about Jackie's teenage dream of becoming a writer. And we learn what advice she would give her 15-year-old self. And we find out why she is a looking forward type of person at the same time as being obsessed with history. So what an absolute privilege this week for my latest nostalgia interview to interview Jackie Double. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Jackie Double with me this afternoon, and we are here to talk about nostalgia. Now, Jackie, of course, we've known each other because we both work in student support, and you work obviously in the School of Arts, and how long have you been based there?
About 9 years.
So you've done the job, well, pretty much the same sort of length of time that I've been senior tutor here in Seckle. And very often, of course, it's often the same students or, particular joint honour students. So we haven't met very many times.
No.
But we know of each other. So this would be a good opportunity to get to know a little bit about you and your background. So do you want to sort of, starting, as far back as you're able to go, tell me a little bit about where you were from.
I was born in Wales, in Colwyn Bay. I'm one of six children, so big family. I lived in Wales till I was about four and then came back to the UK. My family actually go back generation after generation in the Potteries. So we're a family of potters. So in Stoke-on-Trent, although my mum would insist I told you that I lived in Newcastle under Lyme, because that's the slightly posher bit. Hilariously. My dad was a fireman. And moved from, well, stayed in the Potteries actually all the way until university. So lived in Wales, moved to England, and then it was interesting actually having had that move because I think my mum really wanted me to go to school as soon as we came to England, but I'm one of those September birthdays. So actually she wanted me to go to school whilst I was younger than everybody else, but actually I went a little bit older than everybody else. But I was I think a very confident, clever and questioning young person from quite an early age. And I could read. I didn't have to learn to read. I could just read. So I think my parents, who had left school when they were 15, I was quite a different sort of child to appear as the third one. And then 6 years later, I have three other siblings. And I think potentially they appeared because my parents then became Mormons. So they went into the Mormon church when I was, so I probably was about six. So I suspect then the teaching of the fact that you're supposed to keep having lots of children probably impacted the fact that I had then a younger set of siblings. And Yeah, so that was kind of my background.
It's interesting, actually. First of all, Corwin Bay, because you're the second person I've interviewed who's from Corwin Bay, but not somewhere I'd associate that person. It was someone who taught me at Lampeter many years ago, and he moved to Shropshire. And my sister used to live and work in Keele University.
Oh,
so I was aware of that whole, the potteries and the different parts of the potteries and the different sort of calibre of the towns and which ones you want to be best associated with.
Yeah. Keele's very new.
No, and it's a lovely part of the world, but it's interesting what you're saying about being a child, because particularly if you've got these different associations, I mean, children, mine are very young, but they do really pick up on different accents, the different things that you can do in different places, different associations.
Yeah.
And I guess, on the one hand, these days, things are very corporate. You know, you always got the big chains. You know, wherever you go, there's always a McDonald's or somewhere that, you know, children sort of gravitate to.
Yeah, yeah.
But did you find anything, you know, growing up in the two different places, did you sort of, like, look back and think, you know, that's the Corwin Bay? Although it depends how young you were when you moved, of course. But is that their sort of association that you've got these, like, do you demarcate different parts of your childhood depending on where you were living?
Probably not. I mean, we moved within Stoke-on-Trent as well. So I probably do. I'm kind of very much, I fix on buildings and houses. So I remember where I was living, as in the house, rather than how old I was. So the numerical side of memory is I'm very poor at. But what the building was like, I can probably give you a really detailed floor plan.
Yeah.
So I've got more of a mapping sense of memory. And I don't have any visual memory at all. So I can't rely upon bringing back a picture of something. So Wales, I have probably more association. I've got memories, very specific memories of living in Wales. My mum and dad for a time ran our house as a B&B. And I remember all of us living when the rooms were rented out. Mm. We were all living in the kitchen and my dad made these makeshift bunk beds for us all to fit into. Yeah. And then we were allowed back into the rooms when the season finished, as it were. So I remember things like that, even though I was probably quite young. I remember the dog we had when we lived there, and I really remember the beach. And I can remember the view out of the window, not because I can picture it, but because I kept seeing it. So my grandma also lived in a house slightly further down the road and opposite us. And my uncle and aunt and cousins also lived in the same place, so we kept going back year after year, so it's cemented memories. So there are some I can tell you definitely there from me being four, but there are lots that are probably me just amalgamating many visits into it.
No, yeah, memories from childhood are definitely often very composite, but I always used to find, even when I went to university, I'd be away for just a matter of weeks or a month, and I might visit my parents for the weekend.
Yeah.
But everything seems out of proportion. The house I returned to, because I'd been away for a period and I was just sort of getting used to being away for the first time, the dimensions seemed very different. It was either a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller than I remembered.
Yeah.
Then I'd go back after that weekend back to university, and again, everything, I think it's that sense of growing up. And I guess maybe I was doing it at 18, what many people must do it at a younger age, but just that sense of being really aware of your environment, because suddenly you're shaping it rather than having it shaped by you.
Yeah.
And going away to university was a perfect example of that. But suddenly it's like, oh, you know, you have to find your own way from A to B rather than have a parent guiding you.
Do you
have those sort of senses?
I do.
As well?
I think maybe I talked about this actually recently with my older sister, and we both realised that we never got taken to school by an older person.
Yeah.
We always made our own way to school, including crossing some very busy main roads.
Yeah.
So my sister, I was saying to her, I can remember, or she remembered as well, us walking to school together, but she had no memory of me coming back with her. So we both deduced that she probably left earlier and I used to have to make my own way back. But that was from the very beginning of starting school. So I was making my own way at the age of about five, quite a distance.
Because quite a few people that I've spoken to so far have referred to this notion of stranger danger. You know, with these days, it's unthinkable that you'd let your children go home or go to school on their own.
Yeah.
Whereas when I was younger, I do remember.
Absolutely.
I mean, I went everywhere with my parents, but I do remember at least going from the school bus home, which wasn't a long walk, but it seemed a lot longer when I was like 7 years old.
Yeah.
But doing that on my own.
I think in one sense, how I'm very interested in history. And having spoken to my grandma about her childhood and her growing up, I think for whatever reason, my childhood was more like an older one than it was like perhaps my peers were having. So we roamed. We just were out. We could go wherever we wanted. We knew there was a line where this big main road was and that we were told if we went down there, it would be really dangerous. We still went, obviously. But we would walk between our family home and my grandfather's house, which was miles and miles through back streets and across quite open countryside with no concern whatsoever. We wouldn't even phone to say we got there. This is before mobile phones or anything.
Absolutely.
So someone just waved goodbye to three very young children and waited for them to return later.
Did you find that very different with your own children? You know, did you sort of look back and think, gosh, there's no way I would let what happened to me, you know, happen to them, you know, because the sense of danger, which I guess as a parent, you know, children are often oblivious to the, you know, the parents are worried about them, but but you want them to enjoy their childhood, but at the same time, you're always looking over your shoulder.
I think so, although maybe I've thought about that quite a bit before, and I think the difference, there are two slight differences for me, which is my kids both had medical conditions that were quite threatening to them to be well. So they needed a little bit more of somebody being aware of what they were doing and where they were, particularly the youngest, who was diagnosed so young with type 1 diabetes. And also, I think roads are so different. So for us, we knew which was the main road and we knew which weren't busy roads. There's hardly a difference now between a small side road and what you'd call a main road. People drive and they park. The cars are so much more abundant that I'm not sure that there's the same freedom, because actually you're hemmed in a bit more by all the roads around you. I think we were very keen, because we were, on the one hand, we knew how much the kids needed to be watched carefully. And on the other hand, I was really aware of how to gain independence for them. Yeah. So I think I was constantly aware of that friction between those two lines. Yeah. And where I felt uncomfortable, I would push myself to get them to do things despite my feeling uncomfortable. But it was a much more conscious process for me, and I suspect it was a totally unthought through, unconscious process for my parents.
Yeah, but I always find it interesting when grandparents are interacting with their grandchildren, and almost as though sometimes, because they're not directly responsible for it in the same way, they can almost like take their foot off the brake a little bit and just say, well, actually, you know, and enjoy the childhood because they've got it for a limited time.
I agree.
But as parents, you know, I remember my parents always being on edge. It may have been just the stage of their lives, they were younger, but now, you know, when they're with the grandchildren, they you can see that they're really enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
I thought you did. I'm not sure you enjoyed to the same extent when I was young, you know.
Well, if you think about it as well, if you put it mathematically, my mum had three under fives. And then 6 years later, she had three more under fives. So she just didn't have the time. She was busy.
And the Mormon connection is interesting. Has that followed through in any way in the family?
No. I think everybody sort of moved away from the church when I think I was about 13. But I'd been a member of the church to form many of my main friend groups. So it was quite hard to have... You know, you're a kid, you're taken into something which is a bit restrictive and boundaried and tells you what you can eat, what you can drink, what you should read, what you should watch, how you should be as a woman, how you should be as a man. All those things. I'm now an atheist, I'm afraid. I think I did my bit for religion. But so their stepping away was stepping away from a religion. Me, it was stepping away from my friends. So that's quite a hard thing to do at that point. I think that was quite a big moment for me.
And for me, going to university also coincided with when I kind of really understood the nature of my own faith journey. Because I used to go to my Anglican church. I was a server in my local church. And I was studying religion at school. It was a church school I went to. But it was only when I went to university that I thought, I'm allowed to, through my essays, through my studying, able to ask the questions I want to without fear of asking the wrong question or being told you shall not do that. And I just stopped going. I had no, therefore I kind of felt that all the interests, the questions which I, you know, was I going to church every week because I wanted to sort of come away with the answer to the meaning of life? And then perhaps I found that I could not just go there on a Sunday and have someone impart that to me. in a very ritualistic form. I could go and, you know, I was, you know, in within a year of being at university, I was studying about near-death experiences and all questions around myth and questions about the nature of God and life after death. And I thought, these are the really big questions.
Yeah.
And nobody was saying, well, it's not okay to ask those questions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for me, the faith somehow became subsumed within a broader academic study. And I think I obviously found that home pretty early on, because in that sense, I've never left.
That's really interesting, because I would say the thing I found as a female being brought up in that church the most frustrating was you were not party to discussions about the belief systems or about anything that was happening within the room. And I was probably, even though young, I had read the Bible. It was one of the only books. I didn't have a huge number of books around me as I was growing up, but I could read from a very, very early age, so I would read anything I could get my hands on. So I'd read most of Shakespeare by the time I was 10, because my grandma had it on a shelf. I'd read Caravan to Vacarez, because it was a Reader's Digest book that my mum had on a shelf. How, I don't know. Where it came from, I don't know. I had no idea that it was this. I think about now what I was reading when I was a kid, and it's quite scary. But that means they missed a trick, because I was the person in the room that would want to debate with them and talk to them about stuff. And actually, I felt, because I was a woman, I wasn't given that opportunity at all.
But the one thing I find, actually, is that sometimes when I'm outside of this sort of context, you know, if I'm with my students, we have all those, you know, we can talk about, in with critical distance, the nature of faith and religion. But I'll be in the supermarket and somebody says, oh, what do you do? What do you teach? And as soon as I say religion, sometimes I think, oh, gosh, you know, where's this going to go? Because you know that then the conversation, you know, you have no control over those parameters. And then you often have people tell you about their problem with religion. Or the question I often get is, so which church do you go to, or do you believe in God?
Yeah.
Questions which we would never ask our students.
Yeah.
So it's like the elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, so the best way sometimes to avoid those questions is to study religion, because it's a safe space.
Yeah.
But outside of that, sometimes I kind of feel I lose those, the wider parameters.
It's really, really interesting. And I do remember as a child finding it fascinating that I'd been christened and then baptised and trying to work out what that meant. What if you believe what you're being told, what does it mean that I have been, you know, taken in formally by two very different faiths? And I remember thinking about that quite a bit in the long dark hours of the night, worrying about what happens then when you die.
No, and I think that's what made me, you know, and in a way, although I may no longer, you know, I may not have the answers to those questions, I know what the questions are, and I know the many answers to them. So in that sense, I can get sustenance from the fact that, you know, the knowing, you may not know the answers to all the questions, but the fact that you're able to probe and ask and think and inquire without somebody saying, oh, that's off limits, that for me is actually sufficient.
And it's interesting, because I could say to you all the things that I'm not doing now because I was a Mormon, but I'd also say there are some things that I got from being part of that church that were to do with the individuals making it up and what they do, what you were engaged with. So I did the first bits of theatre, first bits of performance singing, dances, you know, square dances, went to see amazing sort of theatre shows and things that they would put coaches on to take you to. So there were brilliant experiences culturally within that, but not without anyone really being aware of how you're growing as an individual whilst they give you all of those. It's a very weird thing to do, isn't it, to give you experience and at the same time expect you to only come out in one way.
In one way, yeah. And that's, well, we have that in America often, you know, with particular schools where, you know, you're not allowed to teach evolution, you know, issues around intelligent design. And actually there was a funny sort of counterpoint to that when I was working on a book on Christmas a few years ago, and I said to my students during religious studies, it was we had a class on Christmas and film, I think it was. So I said to them, you know, if you had to sum up Christmas in one word, what would that be? And only one of them said going to church, but several of them said meeting up with friends or family or eating lots of food or drink. And one of them said clubbing. And I thought, so as many students, that Christmas was about clubbing as it was about religion. And I thought, and again, very interesting, is that sense of what you get. So like your memory of being in the within the Mormon community, no doubt, is that there were friendships, which may, have they lasted to today? Are you still in touch with many of those friends?
No. In fact, I'd say none.
Yeah.
The only friends that we still have from the church, I think, are with, this is fascinating, the two missionaries who came to our door. You know, the Mormons do missionaries. Yeah. American missionaries knocked on the door, and we're still in touch with one of them.
Yeah.
After all that time. So the person who was the first person we ever spoke to within the Mormon church, my parents spoke to, they really became a family friend. And my parents, even after they'd left the church, and interestingly, the missionary left the church as well.
Yeah.
Went over to stay with their family in America.
But that can often say something about childhood, because I've, for many years, and no doubt why I'm studying nostalgia, this desire to reconnect with university friends, but that's when I came of age. But school friends, much less so, because that was a period in my life where I kind of felt I didn't really have my sense of identity, who I was.
Yeah.
So therefore, meeting up with school friends would be effective meeting up with not just a stranger, because they will look so different, because, you know, somebody who was 9 will now look very different. It was at least 18 or 20 when you go to university, people generally are, you know, sort of they're already adults by that point. But if you go back to, you know, meet up with friends from school, you find that you all have moved off in different directions. At least my university friends generally were doing humanity subjects like me, because that's where I went to study. It was an arts-only university. But you then, you know, find that people you went to school with, you know, might be doing completely different things, and you haven't shared their journey to the same extent. And actually, there is one school friend that I have connected with on Facebook, and he's now turned very right-wing, very pro-Brexit, and representing all sorts of views, which I did not associate with him, and he didn't associate with himself when he was younger. And I was thinking, this, it's almost as though that's what happens when you cross a line almost. Sort of, you know, you sort of get in touch with somebody who's so far involved in a past that you don't recognise yourself, and you don't quite know where that's going to take you, because the things you had in common at the age of 8, like Doctor Who, you know, unlikely in your mid-40s to sort of still necessarily be the tie that binds.
And it is as well, it's working out why your what is your community together. So your community was the school, and that's gone. So there isn't that thing to bind you anymore. So what other... So I have that experience really as well. School, I definitely don't have contact. I sort of know of a few people. I do know of some people because my sister married the brother of one of my schoolmates at junior school. So I still am very aware of their lives, but I don't particularly meet up with them. And I'm probably aware of what's happened to some other school friends, but I'm not in that sort of contact with them. But I had, I made lots of connections, very, very close. Hard to describe connections when my kids both have their medical condition diagnosed, because you reach out to this online worldwide community, and these communities, you have something you know you're going to have in common for a very, very long time, but there comes to be a point where you are just the parent of someone with this condition, not the person with the condition, and you start stepping away from it, and then what happens to your community? So I'd say I've probably got 5 or so really close friends still within that community, but I'm still acquaintances, and probably would be able to have a phone conversation with about 60 or 70 people from that. But I think if I added up, I was probably in contact with thousands of people from the particular role I had as well, patient representation. So it is strange how those sorts of relationships can wax and wane. And it can be very much to do with your own personal experience. Some of those people would still regard themselves very much as parents of children with type 1. But I don't. I regard myself as a parent of my two children, and it's their type 1 now. It's not mine anymore. So it doesn't give me that community any longer.
No, and a different analogy, but when children a very, and my eldest daughter is the same, you know, she'd have a best male friend, a boyfriend, and, you know, the parents would offer, you know, the parent of the boy would say something along the lines of, oh yeah, apparently, you know, they're talking about getting married, and they're like 4 years old, you know, and of course you think it's really funny, but you think it's very sweet, but you also know that realistically, in 2 or 3 years' time, they're probably not even going to see. They're not even at the same school anymore.
Yeah.
So they're not in contact. Mm. But a year ago, it was sort of like they were the best friends. And of course, they imagine that they're going to be best friends forever.
Yeah.
And I used to have friends like that.
Yeah,
and you imagine that you do all these wonderful things together because you happen to live on the same estate.
Yeah, yeah.
Therefore, you're all going, you know, whatever you do in the future, you're going to do it together because this is an important friendship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you want to mark that. And you know at the age of 4 or 5 that this is a valuable, you have all these things in common.
Yeah.
Realistically, new friendships will develop. And you go to secondary school sometimes and meet some of the same people that you knew, say, in primary school, but you didn't necessarily go to the same junior school.
Yeah.
And already you've got nothing in common.
Yeah.
You don't mix with the same people and you don't sit with each other in class.
Yeah.
So and that actually stays with you sometimes, I find. Yeah.
My parents, though, met. They were together from being about 15.
Right.
So I find that fascinating because that means they've gone through all of those or went through all of those huge changes together and still remain together. Mm. My mum died. I'm so bad at numbers, but it must be like 11 or so years ago now, 10 years. I can't remember. I have to do it. I have to try and think. How old am I? How old was Tom? So it must be more. It must be 11 or 12 years, actually. Yeah. But they were together, you know, all of her life.
Yeah.
And yet they were those school friends.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, because it almost was my grandparents met during the war. I think they were both 20 at the time. Maybe just one of them had just turned 21. But they were from very different, but they were both engaged to other people from their own villages.
Right.
But it was because of the war that then after meeting, they ended up living in Cardiff, which is where my grandmother was from. But it's interesting that they then stayed together forever. My grandfather always had his Worcestershire accent. But, you know, if it hadn't been for the war, he would have married a woman from his village in Worcester. And my grandmother was married to a man from Cardiff. And, you know, they would have presumably spent the rest of their lives in those, but you know, in that same community. But now I went to university at the age of 18, and now I live in a very different part of the world to where I'm from. But I've got family members, cousins, who've never left Cardiff.
Yeah.
They often never see each other. They're in different parts of Cardiff, but they all live pretty much the same place that they always have done. And I find that interesting in the way in which different sort of social perceptions are then cultivated.
Yeah, so if you looked at my family in that way, you would say my parents, they moved, obviously they moved between the Potteries and Wales, but actually that's not an unnatural movement. That area is very closely tied together. And they had family living in Wales, so they moved to someone. Then they moved back to the Potteries. But they had 6 children, and of those 6 children, we live all over the world. So actually the step from one generation to the next generation being an international one is really small, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
But their parents, both of their parents, would have still been Potteries people. My grandfather was one of 16 children. So the real, real working class roots for both of them. Actually, so they made a first small step, and then their children have made much bigger steps.
No, and in that sense, it was always funny. I remember being at university and then talking to my parents about the friends I'd met and mentioning all these different countries and nationalities and ethnicities and just a very different sort of world, because it's almost, I went to West Wales, to a part of the world that sort of is, you know, there's no railway line, so it was very rural and very Welsh speaking. And yet I had friends from, you know, United Arab Emirates or from China or from Australia, as well as different regions of the UK. And it was breathtaking, but I kind of felt it was like a microcosm of the whole world.
Yeah.
It's kind of no wonder I didn't want to leave in some respects, because there was more of a mix and a fascinating sort of, almost like anthropologically, you know, the chance to study so many different, you know, people and the interactions therein, than happened in the big city of Cardiff, which is where I'm originally from.
Yeah.
So university for me was sort of when it all began. I kind of felt that I started you know, I grew up on the day I went to university in 1991. It feels that way.
Yeah.
Because suddenly it was like, wow, and I'm responsible for this, rather than, you know, you're in this school because your parents send you there through accident of birth, etc.
Yeah,
that was my first real choice.
Yes, and I don't know if your experience was the same as mine. I was the first person to go to university.
Yes, well, my sister, but same generation. My sister's 3 years older.
Yeah.
And we both went to university and never left because we both, you know, work in the same sector. But yeah. So you were the first to go.
So I was the first in either side of the family to go. And that I don't think anyone knew how it worked. How it was meant to be, that if you go to university, it felt, I think, the pattern of you have left to go and do X job or have your own family or your house was what they thought going to university was. So as soon as I went, my room was gone. I never, ever, ever stayed back at home again for more than a week after that moment.
No.
So from 18, that was it. And that's quite an interesting thing as well, because it means you really are, you left and you are now totally your own person.
But you know when you go back during vacations, or maybe that didn't apply in the same way, but I used to find, or particularly, well, not just vacations, end of the degree. So many of my friends, this is interesting. So it's almost like, you know, in the Wizard of Oz, you know, at the end of the day, Dorothy has to go home, you know, ultimately. Yeah. But I found, interestingly, that really that's what I didn't want to do, because I did, but my home was now the university where I grew up. So that became my sort of self-made home.
Yeah.
Very close to my parents, always have been, and then didn't live that far away, really.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that so many of my friends experience life and freedom and all the things that they, you know, wanted to do but never thought, never dreamt possible, but then return to their homes, understandably, because, you know, they have no money and they have to find work. But at the age of 21, reverted to doing what they were doing I'd never left home.
You know,
I went to university, and apart from the odd school trip, really had never spent a night away from home.
Yeah.
But once I had that taste of freedom, I knew that it was a one-way process. Yeah, I could never go back.
Yeah. I had a very similar thing, I think, which is I just made the choices that allowed me to still keep living independently. So I don't think I had quite the same moment of going, oh, shall I go back? There was no going back. There was no space. So I had to make choices of what I did next that meant I could still live independently. So, and that meant balancing. I don't know. I'd always had dreams of being an actor or being a writer. And neither of those things are easy to do if you haven't got money behind you somewhere or something behind you, either someone really rooting for you to do it and encouraging you to do it despite all the problems. So I think I sort of went for as safe an option as possible. So I went and did PGCE so that I was a secondary school teacher. So I had another year of study, but it wasn't going on to further study. It was studying so I could be a teacher. And then I worked in a theatre company in theatre and education for a while. And then when that stopped, I went into teaching. So I took very safe decisions because I knew there wasn't any other safety net underneath, which is quite different to my children's experience. They definitely have space to come back to. And again, I don't think anyone sat and thought that through. I don't think anyone was saying, this is how we'll deal with this situation. It's just how it, you know, grew.
Yeah, it's very easy, isn't it, to look back and think, oh, there's a pattern. But often it's chance, it's luck, it's fate.
Yeah.
But then we find that in itself becomes the structure, becomes the pattern. It's almost like, well, it's worked out for a reason. And therefore you think, oh, well, and that's the type, you know, that's the great thing about nostalgia sometimes is that, well, there are two different ways, we'll go into that a bit later on, but that notion sometimes when you can say, well, this fell into place then, you know, there was a particular challenge, this is what then happened, or we managed to, you know, think of students sometimes who were worried they're not going to get their degree.
Yeah.
And then it all works out on the night sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you say, but that goes to show that in 20, 30 years' time, they can look back and say, okay, sometimes, even when things look really dire, when there's real adversity or challenge, somehow you might have it within you to rise to the occasion. You know you've done it before. You've got that means. There's something from within that can make you sort of achieve what you want.
It's a sort of resilience, isn't it? And I think you, I'm probably a very practical person because I had to make very practical decisions. And in some cases, I would perhaps say that I didn't reach the potential I might have had because I didn't give myself the chance to just do something completely without safety. But I don't regret at all any of the choices I made. I'm not that sort of a person who looks back and regrets things very often. Yeah. I think I'm very practical.
Yeah. Well, what about, I mean, the thing for me when I was really young, the charts, music in the playground, I was obsessed. I used to write down the charts on a Sunday. That was sort of my go-to thing. There was the sense of, you know, self-identity, and of course in relation to others, you know, if the record I liked was number one, you know, I almost sort of felt the validation that, you know, therefore my musical tastes have somehow been corroborated or been sanctioned. Did you have any of those sort of interests? No. Were you interested in music growing up?
No, none.
Really?
None of that.
Yeah.
It's so strange. I mean, I was very, very aware of John Denver because my mum had John Denver tapes. I was aware of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir because my mum had Mormon Tabernacle Choir tapes. Yeah. And I was aware of story tapes, actually. My world was much more about books. Mm. It was all about reading. Yeah. And I remember going into W.H. Smith's and finding all the books at the back of the shop. And I didn't have my own money until I started a paper round. And I did a paper round from the first moment I could get one. I was doing two paper rounds, one in the morning, one in the evening. So I had money. And I remember going into a shop and I picked a book off the shelf that I thought, I really think this will be great. And I read it. And then, you know, I used to read a book a day. I read so fast and it was totally my world. Mm. I remember going back to the shop and saying, well, where's the next one? And then going, well, it'll be, I don't know. I mean, no, I've just read this one. Where's the next book? And I had no concept that somebody was writing those and it would be another year and a half before I could get it. And I was distraught at the idea that I wasn't going to just get the next book from this because everything I'd been reading had been so old that you could read the complete works of Austen.
There's something in that. I remember reading these. They obviously weren't written by Alfred Hitchcock, but they were these sort of like equivalent of like Junior 5, Secret 7, whatever it is type books. And they came in a series of like 30 or 40, and I read them all. But I remember once going to the library and they didn't have the next one in the sequence. And I remember, and the librarian said, but there are plenty of other books for people your age. And she showed me and I was like, no, I'm not interested in this. And it's complete blank. It's like, no, I know what I want.
Yeah.
You know, you can't hoodwink me into thinking that some, you know. And of course, you know, what it really meant is at a certain age, I only ever read one type of book.
So
that's like somebody who, you know, I suppose I've always had those commitments. Like I would only ever listen when I was young to Radio 1. I was loyal to Radio 1. But why did that come from?
Yeah.
Then later years, Radio 2. So John Denver, actually my daughter who's five, my second daughter, suddenly from out of nowhere, and I got her on tape just the night before last, she was doing it, singing Take Me Home Country Roads with the West Virginian. She really emphasises the West. And it's like, you know, where did that come from at her age? So again, you know, the things that we're exposed to kind of, you know, make their mark. But you are right with books as well. If you find a particular author, then it's very easy to then go for the next book by that same author, whether it's Jane Austen or obviously Shakespeare, rather than necessarily to experiment.
Mm.
And I've always been a bit like that, I think. So sort of know lots about a particular, in a very niche area, but not really aware of the wider infrastructure.
That's interesting, because I think I'm the exact opposite. I think I had no understanding that you would ever think you could only read a thing. I had no idea that anything was off limits. So I would read literally anything. And I remain very eclectic in my interests. So I've got quite good general knowledge. I remember being, as a child, the thing I used to ask my dad most was, ask me some questions, ask me some questions. I always liked the idea of knowing things and seeking out information. And I think now the idea... I remember so many questions, it being days and days, I'd read things and I'd have questions constantly occurring that I wanted to know the answer to. And of course, when we were kids, there weren't necessarily the ways of finding those answers. Mm. I certainly didn't have the tools. I didn't have a family that were aware of any of those tools. So I the idea of having a phone in your pocket now that as a question occurs to you, you can just ask it and find an answer. Yeah. I imagine who would... I think I'd have gone doolally as a child because I had so many questions. I wanted to know everything and anything about literally everything in the world.
Yeah, and it's too easy these days in the same way that if you want to hear a particular song, you can download it instantly. There's no, what the great pleasure that you have from going into W.H. Smith and looking for that book and making that journey there, just as with the paper round, you know, actually there's a physical, you know, there's a structure there, but, you know, it almost feels a bit too easy sometimes that you could, if you want something, you can get it.
Yeah.
And I always remember that it was the process of acquiring or waiting for or being able to pay for something or the pilgrimage. It might be on a Saturday because you're in school in the week.
Yeah.
And it was that sense of looking forward to something rather than having it all on a plate. If you don't like it, just go on to the next thing. Here, once you had it, once you bought it, you were stuck with it.
Yeah, and I think I'd had that sort of experience with my reading as I started out because I just would, the first thing I'd do in anyone's house is I'd go and look at the bookshelves and we'd go and visit people and I'd just grab a book and sit in the corner and ignore everybody and read. So I think that sort of feeling of having to seek something is always with me, but I've embraced entirely the modern world of having a Kindle.
Yeah.
So in the same way that perhaps music for you, you probably find pieces of music that you go to which are for your mood or circumstance. Yeah. I've got books that I go to. If I'm feeling a certain way, I want to read a certain section of a book. So having a Kindle where I can just go in and find anything I want to read is just a miracle.
No, and I'm the same. And actually, the funny thing is, I'm very happy to download books because books are also going to take a while to read. Whereas sometimes I like hard copies of films. I like to have that film to put into the machine. So it's the complete inversion of the way it should be.
Yeah.
But I think it's also because with the books... And also, you know that if I lose... if it's going to take a... I don't tend to read in one day. But if I'm going to be reading a book for a while, because you can get dog-eared, you can lose it. But it's on the Kindle. You know, even if I lost the Kindle, well, at least I'm not going to lose what's on the Kindle. Because it's, you know, there's a central resource somewhere, an account that you can activate.
The thing I miss most about reading, and I still do read hard copy books, so real books, as we call them. Particularly if they're history ones or anything about nature, I want to be able to hold it whilst I'm reading it. There's something about the transfer of actual factual information into your head that way, but fiction I don't tend to buy as much now at all. I could map a book. I was really well known during my A levels and doing the degree that you could tell me a quote from any book and I'd find the page within a few seconds. So I don't have any visual memory, so there's no mind's eye for me. But I can map the pages of a physical object to the point where I can recall where the words are within the book.
And did that serve you well at university? Because that's an amazing skill. What was your degree in?
English literature.
Well, there we are.
I mean, it was bound to happen.
I was going to say, if you'd said, engineering, I would have said that was the wrong degree.
What did you do?
English
lit.
Yeah.
But I was really lucky. So I did a course. I went to Sheffield University. And the first year at Sheffield was brilliant because you could take as much as you wanted. And I have still got this eclectic desire to know as much as possible. So I did a course in English language, a course in ancient history, a course in Old English, the language, and English literature. So I was constantly wanting to do more. I think I'm one of those people, I should have been in the Renaissance and I should have been male because I wanted to learn everything. I didn't want to restrict myself to any particular subject. And I've really felt that for my children as well, actually, who are very able and could have gone to sciences or humanities. Or I don't get why we try and push ourselves into these channels at all. So Sheffield suited me really, really well. And it was quite hard, actually, to only say I'm going to do English literature. But I did.
But then again... Within those, one thing I discovered at university, certainly, is that the subject that I did at A-level was not the subject that was available. Because I did, my degree was in theology, but I did religious studies or religious education? I can't remember at A-level. But either way, it was very biblically based. Yeah. So I'd know lots about the first few books of the Old Testament and John's Gospel and 1 Corinthians. And then... I went to university and suddenly discovered that my subject was so much broader than that, and I embraced that. So in a way, you could say, you know, I did a one-subject degree, but but goodness me, within that, everything from the disestablishment of the church in Wales to questions about near-death experiences or life after death, and belief about God, you know, God in different historical contexts. So, and of course, and then my research later on was in religion and film, you know, my PhD. Yeah. So suddenly it's sort of like, you know, there was never a point when I thought, oh, you know, I'm bored with this subject. But, you know, in that sense, never, you know, there are never going to be enough. There would never be too many books that you can read.
Exactly.
Or read on. How did you find that? Because I know some people who did English for their degree and they were like, you know, all I have time to do, this is people who are students with me and when I was in the University of Wales, they say, oh, you know, I've got to read 2 or 3 books a week and that's all I can manage. I never get to read any commentaries. Whereas for me, it's like the whole point of studying is that you look, of course you have to know what the primary sources are, but you also need to look at the commentaries on those and the perspectives on those texts. So how did you find that to go from having this great love of literature to suddenly reading lots of critical theory?
Very frustrating. Mm. And I probably didn't read as much critical theory because I wasn't really that interested in it. Yeah. Reading the history of the individual who wrote something, that I was interested in. So mine was a much more historical, social sort of history analysis of literature. I really didn't see the point of theory at all. I don't get it. Mm. Why do I need to, as a person who is not the person who wrote that book or lived that life, try and create theories about who did or how they did it?
You've made me think whether in my case there's something autobiographical in what I do, because it's almost as though you say, well, this is the common resource. It might be a text, it might be a particular theory, but then around that I'm reading, I'll do it with politicians, you know, I'll read autobiographies from Conservative and Labour and Lib Dem and etc. politicians. And it's interesting how they both apprehend the same situations, or even within the same parties. Look at New Labour and, you know, the different, you know, obviously they'd all sort of imploded a bit. And you find that, I wonder if there's a part of me that needs to say, okay, you know, this is what this person represents, or you're trying to work out a single person sometimes at different facets of their life. So therefore, the more reading you do, the more, you know, you can think, ah, no, that theory, when applied to the half of what that person did, makes sense of what they did between the ages of, you know, 18 and 23. Yeah. And then the next phase that, or even, in, you know, sometimes you look at people's behaviour towards other people and you think, but they seem so nice. But it turns out that, you know, they have all these, you know, hidden traits, or you think, I didn't know that person had it in them, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think therefore, it's always very interesting, and I'm looking for these sort of also like multiplicity of ways of making sense of one phenomena.
Exactly.
Because nobody, everyone is a composite.
Yeah. I think that's very familiar. That sounds like my approach to it. So I don't think I excelled in my degree because I wasn't really ever going to be someone who would take on all that theory and acknowledge the brilliance of other people writing about other people's writing. Yeah. I was far too interested in the person who wrote and what they wrote.
Yeah.
Which is what I was naturally doing from a very early age. My favourite thing when I read books was if the person writing a book mentioned a book, and then I had another book to go and find.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I love that feeling of a network, a web expanding from one thing that somebody did and taking you off to loads of other things.
No, because I've known some, even academics, who sort of love just creating lists of books. It's almost as though it's not so much the book, but the, if you like, the footnotes or the bibliography that's the most interesting part. Because you read one book on a subject and then you say, well, therefore that book points you in the direction of that book and another book. So you just draw up this list of go-to sources.
So
almost as though people could just spend the next 30 years of their life just going through all of the, because by that point they'll be, half of them will be out of date.
They'll
all be out of date, actually.
I mean, I think the thing you're mentioning there is a very academic one, which is you're interested in other people who've written about a thing and what they read and what that person wrote about a thing. I like it when the author of a book writes about someone else who wrote a book. I want to read the book they were reading when they wrote the book. So it's much less a commentary about that person. I'm much more interested in the actual thing itself. And interestingly, not only did I read everything we were asked to read, that for me was easy and delightful. I reread it. I reread a lot for exactly that same reason, which is, I think for me, because I have a very particular way of mapping information, I need to go back to it to engage with it again. I can't bring it to mind in the same way. So I don't have, it's a very visceral, physical attachment to a book. So if I want that feeling again, I go and read it again.
And do you ever wonder what the author's of those books would think about what you're doing with those books. Does it matter? And I say that because sometimes I've met filmmakers that I study, and you meet them, and you even, there's one occasion when I said, oh, I studied you for the PhD, expecting them to say, oh, how amazing, how wonderful, thank you. But rather it's more like, uh-oh, you don't want to have, like what I was saying about religion, it's almost like this is a no-go area. But I always find it really interesting that if you invest that amount of time in a product, in a book, in a creative work, you know, is it necessarily a one-way process in the sense the person's created the book and you can do all manner of things with it? You can read it, you can digest it, you can share it, assimilate it, etc. See it as a yardstick for, you know, how to act in your life. But would that person then be interested in your reception of that work? And maybe it doesn't matter, but I always... But that,
I think it
that,
would depend on
up.
The person, probably. I can imagine some authors who are writing because they're very lonely and they want to connect with other people. Yeah. And that's what they're back to you. Yeah. That's where they were coming from with it. Others who are writing, and as soon as it's finished, they don't really want to engage even with the text.
Well,
anymore.
Like Woody Allen is the same. He doesn't even watch. He's on a chat show, and they show a clip from the film he's just made, and he'll look away. He doesn't want to watch it.
Yeah.
It's a finished product. He's on to the next project already.
Yeah, and I have to say, I've done some writing, not in any way to sort of be published or anything, but I did write a novel length piece of writing. My own experience was as it felt like it wasn't mine as soon as it was on the page and done, especially after you'd edited it once. And I remember going back and reading that, and I could almost not recognize I'd written any of it. So I think my style would be that I would let it go. And I wouldn't necessarily have any judgment of what anyone did with it, because I wouldn't remember it as much.
But it's also interesting, I find, that, you know, particular radio presenters who I admire and think, oh, you know, that's maybe even in my teaching, I channel that sometimes, or sort of that way of communication, that, you know, the excitement they bring to what they do, I apply it to my profession. But then again, those individuals themselves are often, you know, right wing. I think of people like Tony Blackburn or Ed Stewart. You know, often their politics is not one that I'd share. And yet, you know, immediately I hear their voice and I think, gosh, you know, this is a real professional at work. And then I think, but if I met them, you know, would I be very disappointed? Because would we perhaps not have all that much in common?
Well, it's interesting because I think what you're talking about there is kind of likability, isn't it?
Yeah.
That is a professional thing, likability, when you are a performer. And anyone teaching or being on the radio or anything, you are, in effect, a performer, aren't you? You're transmitting information through a performance mode. So I would sort of... I have met some people that I thought were absolute heroes, and they've been perfectly lovely, but they've not been the person they were when I was watching them on the film or in the radio. My thing, I think, in the same way that I feel I had quite an old-fashioned childhood in the way my parents let us run around and, you know, we got on with it, I think I had quite old reference points, which is interestingly why I think I have quite a bit in common with Ollie, who studied variety and musical. They were like the current entertainers in my house, even though they weren't the current entertainers, but we didn't listen to 70s comedians or any of that sort of thing. We listened to Arthur Askey and Morecambe and Wise, and all those things were the big things in our house. So I'm pretty sure that had I met any of those people, that behind everybody who is a really fantastic, likeable presence on stage, there could be anything behind it, literally anything.
So I think in my case, I therefore want to channel it into studying that almost rather than just... So I'm not going to be disappointed because I'm already looking at those critical angles. I mean, the time a few years ago when a number of former DJs were accused of all sorts of things, you know, at the time it was almost like, okay, well, this is interesting because I've got no personal relationship with them. I admire their talent, I admire their professionalism. So it was almost as though I was guarding myself for what might then happen. Because otherwise you don't want to look back and think, God, I spent so many years when I was young investing in a particular presenter. You'd come home every day from school, first thing you do, put the radio on, listen to their programme. You know, and it was almost as though it's like, well, okay, that's interesting, but it mattered. But, you know, as long as I make sure that I don't lose sense of my own relationship with that medium and maybe my own past, then it's almost as though that's okay, because there are enough, there need to be filters along, and also for the presenters themselves, they need filters. Otherwise you've got the, what's that Clint Eastwood film, Play Misty for Me, when suddenly there's too much of a relationship between the presenter and the audience, and then of course you end up in trouble because they the relationship of dependency.
One of my favourite authors when I was really young, one of the first people I read as a sort of like proper grown-up author was Thomas Hardy. Mm. And he is someone that I read much more about his life and found this very complicated, potentially not very nice bloke at all, really. Mm. But you do, as soon as you start looking into the lives of even the most sort of like revered authors, Dickens, anyone, you start to find things that you would, with your modern day perspective, go, I find that really uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't know why, but it hasn't stopped me liking things in the same way. It's probably because I'm very bad at remembering things anyway. So I'm very in the moment when I'm reading something.
Yeah.
And I used to be, my mum used to always joke that she could shout fire whilst I was watching a Norman Wisdom film when I was a child, and I wouldn't hear her. Yeah. And they used to shout sweets, fire, anything, and I would still be utterly fixed on watching a film. Yeah. I think my concentration, my focus is in that moment so much that I would allow all the other stuff to go away until after I'd finished it, and then I'm like, consider it all again.
And what about wider things when you were at university, because obviously you were studying literature, but anything else? We covered religion already, but you know, religion, politics, sport, you know, was there a sort of a film, even was there a wider sense of, you know, interests or passions that you went on to cultivate, things that you associate with that era?
I worked very, very hard for money whilst I was at university, so I didn't have a huge amount of time to do much else. I think, again, with the same thing of not quite understanding how it all worked, as my grant disappeared, my parents didn't really realise they were meant to give me any money. So I was really paying my own way a lot. So I worked doing lots of leafleting for comedy clubs, which is where I met Ollie, doing a film library for one of the members of staff at the university, who I think, actually, to be honest, he's a friend now, realised I didn't have very much money and was allowing me to do sort of jobs that would mean I would get some money, which were useful, but I'm not sure that they would have happened had he not realised I was needing money. And then I worked cleaning jobs and worked in pubs. I just constantly was working. So when I wasn't actually doing work for my studies, I was trying to earn money. So there weren't a huge amount, other than doing comedy clubs. So comedy became a big part of my extracurricular. But I did, a small part of my degree was also doing theatre. So I did drama, so there were quite creative opportunities with that as well. So I was getting satisfied creatively, but I didn't really have... I was very sporty, actually, as a youngster. I used to play for the county for lots of different things, and athletics and things. But I didn't carry any of that on at university. There just wasn't time to do that as well as anything else.
Yeah. So it sounds like there were great creative opportunities, but almost as they were very pocketed. It was almost as though you had, you know, to make the most of them. Maybe you appreciated them more because you knew that you couldn't sort of indulge as you'd like, because you had to make sure that, as with the pocket, with the paper round when you were younger, you know, you were sort of ensuring that when you weren't in lectures, you were, you know, making ends meet.
It was practicalities. It was really practicalities.
Yeah, there's a common theme here, I think.
There is.
You're very practical.
I am very practical. I also had, when I did my A-levels, my very last, that final year of A-levels, when I was doing exams and everything, I had glandular fever. And it didn't really go. So I had what they called then post-viral syndrome, which now I think they would probably start to call chronic fatigue or something like that. And it meant, actually, I was, whilst I was being deeply excited and motivated at uni, I also just had these energy levels that, but I was working very, very, very hard, but I was aware I was always exhausted. And I might have been exhausted with or without the glandular fever because I was doing a lot of hours. But I found it very, very challenging to feel anything other than terrible fatigue.
But that leads on. So I want to finish off with a few philosophically based questions. But, you know, I mean, are your memories, first of all, predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life?
Yeah, but I'm also quite good at spotting the bits where things weren't positive and thinking, actually, why was that happening? And what could have been done about it, and who should have been doing something. But I think I'm less, I have probably fewer not positive memories about family and things. I can acknowledge something, but still remember I had a really warm and loving family and still do have really, really lovely siblings and dad, you know. So I'm very, very blessed from that point of view. But I'm definitely aware of not necessarily going as far as I would have liked to do in other directions. And things in life, you know, I'm one of those people who had big events happen and you have to flex, you have to be practical. So my kids both being diagnosed, that meant my career stopped. So there are moments where I could go, I wonder what would have happened, but I don't tend to do it very often because it's not my normal thing.
Yeah, because the question that often arises is whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences.
I think you definitely can be nostalgic about negative things. And I would say that's because it's who you were at the moment things were happening to you that you revisit. It's not necessarily whether it was positive or negative. So I can think back to the me of lots of different moments that were both brilliant and really terrible and have sympathy and like that person still and not regret that person being there. I think some of the things I've learned and the person I've become have definitely happened because of very negative experiences. Which is interesting then. Does that mean they were negative?
Yeah, because it's easy to gloss over what's happened. But I mean, I've always kept a diary, and I'm glad I have, because at least there's a kind of authentic kernel of what may have happened to correct that over. It was easy to, you know, think, oh, they were good days. You think, well, no, they're good days, but you were stressed about your essay deadlines. You were stressed about what work you were going to do at university, stressed about where you'd be living in accommodation the next year, all the rest of it. So, but also, if you can write back to what you were saying earlier, if you can rise above some of those challenges and just sort of show, okay, you know, I didn't let it defeat me, then you kind of feel it's a plus. And then 20, 30 years on, the danger is sometimes that you can put this gloss on, because it worked out all right in the end. I mean, a good example, my grandparents. My grandfather in his 80s and early 90s was, you know, wrote up, he'd always wanted to do that, his story of when he met my grandmother, and I've definitely inherited that sort of side of things. But it's interesting because you look back on the account of when they met during the war, and you know that the war's going on around and they may never see each other again, but it's this beautiful story. And he was so happy, but you're thinking, but you were really, really happy, but it was during the war. And in a way, it's that paradox, you know. And I was talking to Helen in your school about her work in drama, and, you know, the question, but during the First World War, were people still going to the theatre? Or you could say, you know, during Brexit, with people in 20 years' time, did people still go to the cinema? Or was, because the country was paralysed? But of course, that's the interesting thing, isn't it?
And that is an interesting thing. And a diary, I think, is a very interesting part of that as well, because how truthful are we even to ourselves in our diaries? You know, even in the middle of a thing, how much do you really know what's happening? How much are you really aware of that you capture? I think what you've sort of described is that you can question yourself by going back with a diary.
Well, I did something which I didn't think I would do, because I was writing up, I digitized all my old diaries, you know, the ones you used to get from W.H. Smith or Woolworth, you know, and I couldn't write very much. Now, of course, I write, you know, it's pros and cons, because I write way too much these days. But back then, I didn't write very much at all. So a few years ago, when I started going back all over my old university and indeed school diaries, I annotated them in italics, so to make it clear that this is separate from the original entry. I then put on the whole sort of, well, who would have thought? So, of course, as you say, something happened in 1992, but that takes on different significance in terms of what happened 5 or 10 years later, or what I'm doing now. Or my take on that is different in terms of the way I perceive that particular individual now. So, of course, I'd be putting that in. So it's very much a case of like a commentary on that past. But the crucial thing was I didn't disrupt that original rendering, that original entry, that's timeless, but the interpretation can float.
I did a thing when my grandma died of taking my grandma wrote lots of poetry. She was very very much a writer, not necessarily my favourite sorts of poetry, because she was also quite religious, so there's quite a lot of oh dear Lord and all that sort of stuff in it. But when you get past all of that and you look at what it's telling you about her life, it's brilliant. And her, my dad's dad died in the Second World War just before it finished, just before the end of it, probably in friendly fire in Burma. So my dad never knew his dad. He was only very, very little, a few months old. And so my grandma wrote a lot about this lost husband and about their how they met, and probably made this beautiful sort of image in her head of that relationship and things. But she kept him alive for all of us a lot, you know, by constantly referring to him. And in no part because she was also a spiritualist, so she believed she was going to astral planes and having these encounters with him again. So one of the things we did after she died is we got all the family together and we went and walked the path that she was taking in one of her poems, where she was describing having met Douglas, her partner, and walked through the Consul Valley with him. So we did this walk, and at that time I was recording everybody and asking them questions about my grandma, and I was particularly recording my mum and dad. So earlier, before we did the walk through the Consul Valley, we went back to Hanley, and I got my mum and dad to walk me around the streets, because I didn't know where they were, where my grandma was born. And I was just talking to them about my grandma's life and everything. And now I listen to that tape, and all I want to say to me is, ask your mum about her life. Because I've got so much information about my grandma, not my mum.
Because you take, it's so easy to take that for granted, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because they're always around. It only occurred to me a few years ago that I don't really have much sound of my family members. You know, I speak to my parents all the time, but I don't have a recording of them. And they would never do an interview like this. So I have asked them, but in a way, that would, you know, but that would be wonderful. But
wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And I sort of think with a diary and with photos, actually, I take a lot of photos. I want to go, just turn the camera that way a bit.
Yeah.
Why were you taking that photo? Why aren't you going that way? You just wish, actually, you could go back. A diary, when I look back at the things I kept, I didn't keep a constant diary, but little sections of time. I want to go back and say, not that. Don't tell me about that. Tell me about that thing that I remember at the time, but I can't remember.
But in a funny way, it's never too late, because you may not be able to, you know, you may not have asked that question 20 or whatever years ago, but you can still try to, you know, work. So, I mean, one way around this might be to say, well, I don't know what would have happened if I turned the camera a bit to the left, but you can imagine that. And therefore there's a way of writing about that, the off-camera moments. Because I'm the same with you. It's always, you know, you meet people, you have a wonderful time, and there's all these wonderful memories, but you also sort of know that there's more to the story than what you know. So other people's photographs, other people's diaries, or other people's, you know, verbal accounts, sometimes they clash, sometimes you know that the dates don't sort of quite match up. But generally, you do get a pretty good sense of, you know, a collective sense of what may have happened in a particular era. But we've all got particular ways into that. We may not recognise somebody else's narrative, like minutes at a meeting, you know. Two people could take minutes of a meeting you've attended, and you don't recognise it as a meeting you attended. Either of them,
It's a hard one as well, though, because how do... Because to dare to do that whilst there are still other people who can read your interpretation when you've looked sideways and imagined it is a bit scary, isn't it?
But the option is there. But, you know, but you don't have to publish it. That's the difference. Yeah, like my diary. Yeah. It's because I can't, well, for obvious reasons, it's not going to be published while I'm alive. we'll see you in court, you know. But otherwise, yeah, I think that's right. But then you have that freedom because you know that you can write without fear of interpretation.
What about that thing then, like Thomas Hardy, of just burning everything?
No. I know a friend of mine who at university, after university, but allegedly, I heard it from someone else, burnt all her books and notes, because she said, well, I've got my degree now, I've got my certificate, what do I need all this for? I'm the opposite. I have to have backups, everything, digitized versions of things.
Do you?
But it's a constant. It's not just sort of like the thing set in time, it's the interpretation of that. So it's an ongoing process. So the past for me is...
You're your own archivist.
Yeah, I'm aware of... Yeah, in a sense, I am doing that, Even through the interviews, I guess. I'm aware that there is that element of constantly revisiting.
Whereas I approach things about making space all the time, so I'm constantly wanting to let go of things.
Yeah.
So I really don't have... there are some things that I've kept, but lots of things I'll just let them go.
Yeah.
And I like that process of letting something go. Yeah. It's probably what makes me very practical.
Yeah. I'm hoarding at least in my head, if nowhere else. Just a couple more questions. Would you say that you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? Or to put it another way, what would your 15-year-old self think about what you're doing now?
My 6-year-old self, my 5 or 6 year old self, would have told you that when they grew up, they wanted to be either a rabbit or a teenager. And I thought a teenager meant a receptionist. So then as I got a bit older and someone really said, what do you want to be when you grow up? I said, I really want to work on the tills at the co-op. Because I thought the whole idea, that was such a beautifully clean process. I've never fulfilled that. So I've not fulfilled my dreams of being that little. 15-year-old self was probably already quite practical, but really wanted, I think probably the thing I really wanted to do was write more. I wanted to be a writer. So I haven't done that. I mean, I've written stuff and I do still write things, but I haven't done it in the way of having a career in doing it.
Do you think you might still? Do you think that you might? I mean, is publishing the goal necessarily, or is it more a case that you do this because it's the right thing in the moment? You know, you're doing it for yourself, you're doing it for a wider sort of readership constituency.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I'm not sure I know which one I am, actually. I think I'm probably, when I wrote the other thing that I did that for myself, and that was very much because I needed to just show my brain could still switch back on again whilst I was at home looking after little kids. So that I wouldn't say I regret spending a lot of time writing that, even though nobody else will really read it. I probably am being a bit mean to myself by not writing, because I obviously do enjoy the process of it, and I have lots of ideas of things I want to write. I particularly like writing children's books, so I used to write stories for the kids and then read them to them, and they were a brilliant audience. So perhaps I should just sort of go for that as my goal, and I could achieve that without any problem.
Yeah, but don't then destroy it afterwards.
No, I don't do destruction of anything like that. It's more things, you know, things. And books. I don't particularly feel a need to keep hold of every book I read. Some I do, because just mainly because they've got more of a tangible feeling of how I held them when I was doing particular things. But the text that's inside it, I can let go if I don't feel I need to read it lots again. So no, my poor old 15-year-old self would never have expected to find me here doing this job.
But I suppose by the same token, would you have advice to that 15-year-old, or do you think that 15-year-old would have advice for you today? Do you think, is it possible to sort of go back and have that conversation with yourself in a different period and say, no, don't do that, or do it more?
Oh, I've probably got a really stereotypical response that I would like to tell my 15-year-old self, which is just be a bit happier with yourself. Don't seek to be changing or different. Just be really pleased with who you are, because you're interesting.
No, and my problem is that I've always sort of known, I suppose I'm doing it now with these interviews, you know, almost like chasing that dream, wanting to do something in radio, for example, but never feeling that it was the right thing, or never feeling that I could do it.
Yeah.
Because nobody else around me necessarily thought that I could, or rather the infrastructure wasn't there. It was more a case of, that's an odd thing to do. I went to university and then got sucked into the university system and have loved it, in a way, never looked back. However, there's always a part of me that says, but there's, you know, the rosebud thing almost is like, well, there's still things that haven't yet been actualized. And if they've been niggling away at me for the last 30, 40 years, then in a sense, maybe I need to chase that dream. So maybe that's the advice I'd give myself.
Yeah, I think I probably would as well. Although at the same time, being practical, I'd be very aware that it might change things that I don't want to lose. So I probably wouldn't give myself any advice, because I wouldn't not want to be where I am.
I'm very aware that in many respects, even if I went back and lived the same life that I've lived now all over again, maybe on some level that wouldn't be such a bad thing. That's what I mean. You know, it's not as, I might tweak things and do it differently, but I've also learned from the things that haven't worked out.
And the one thing I would get myself to do is I would get myself to just have a slightly older head on my shoulders, so I would notice the people round me more.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
I wouldn't need to change anything. Yeah. I just want to say, be a little bit more aware of everybody that you're interacting with, and that they may not be here forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My very last question, Jackie, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Looking forward, I think, which is weird because I'm also obsessed with history. So I read huge amounts of history books and things about prehistory more than anything. But I'm very much a looking forward. But I'm a bit of a now and looking forward person. Mm. I like to make change happen. I like to sort of go, how well did that work? Well, let's make it work even better. Mm. I like to design space and have things around that make everything work very smoothly for everybody. Mm. Very process, very practical.
Yeah. I think that word, yes. So that's the abiding word from the interview. That's a good word. Yeah. Jackie, it's been brilliant to catch up with you this afternoon.
Thank you.